Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks for being here with us. We continue with Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin, our guest, Jimmy, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where each Friday, including today, you can find a new episode. At least that's been the case for the last 350 or so Fridays. So check them all out. Today's episode, I forgot. I'm all the way stuck back in the Zodiac episode. And so I'm sorry. I forgot.
The Toynbee tiles.
Oh, the Toynbee tiles. Yeah. Yeah. Weird. All right. The Toynbee tiles. Mm-hmm. Check it out at mysterious.fm or wherever you get your podcasts, or check it out on YouTube, where Jimmy's got all kinds of stuff going on at YouTube. All these questions that we have today, or for the whole day today, have come from the internet, and they got the questions to Jimmy, and Jimmy put them on a page for me, and I get to read them. Jimmy gets to answer them. So it's an Ask Me Anything, but it's the internet version of the Ask Me Anything. And this one comes from Beth, and Beth wants to know about Jimmy. Beth says, "What does a day in the life of Jimmy Akin look like? I know so many of us are in awe of your depth and breadth of knowledge. It would be interesting to see how you structure your day with learning, etc."
Well, of course, I have things going on other than learning. So in order to explain how I structure my day to include learning, I guess I need to mention a few other things. Basically, I wake up sometime between 6 a.m. and 8:30 a.m. And as soon as that happens, I roll out of bed, I get dressed, and I make the long commute from my bedroom to my home office, which is, I don't know, 15 feet or so. Oh,
that's
and
a tough one.
But once I get to my home office, I check my email, and I have certain web pages I check. I check a news aggregator. I have a science news aggregator that I check every day. It's called Real Clear Science. And I may check a few other things. There's a news aggregator I sometimes check. That's instapundit.com for people who are curious. And then I wish everybody on Facebook who has a birthday, happy birthday. And then I start on whatever the work of the day is. And I have a calendar that I keep where I have my appointments. And my appointments are mainly, they're things where I interact with other people, most of them. Like if I need to do a pre-record for Catholic Answers Live, then okay, that's going to go on the calendar. Or if I have a meet-in that I need to attend, like a Catholic Answer staff meeting, then that'll go on the calendar. And so I basically have my appointments, and I make sure that I get ready for my appointments. So like the day before I do a pre-record for Catholic Answers Live, either the day before or even longer than that, before I get the questions ready for it. So I have all my work done to prepare for the meetings in order to have the meetings be effective. Beyond that, I have open spaces. And what I do in the open spaces, that's when I do my learning. Now, I answer email, of course, and at least to the extent I can, which, you know, I can't always, but I'll answer people's questions by email sometimes. And I do research on various projects, and one of the key ways that I learn is by writing about the research I'm doing. So if I'm preparing, for example, an episode of the Jimmy Akin podcast, not the same as Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, I'll be writing a script for it, and I'll be doing some research for that script. And it's just like in school, when you take notes on the lecture you're hearing, you learn the material better. And in the same way, if I am doing research and I'm reading material or watching material or listening to material to learn about a subject, it helps if I write a script based on that, so that it drills down. It's the effective equivalent of note taking. It also forces me to figure out how to express what I've learned in a useful way for others. That's something I put a high priority on, is being able to communicate in an effective way to people, even if they don't have a technical background in something. And by writing a script or an article or a book or a blog post or whatever it is, where I force myself to articulate something, even if it was technical, in a way that's accessible, it also helps me learn how to, it helps me remember it better, and it helps me learn how to express it better. And so writing, whether it's for a podcast or anything else, is a key way that I also learn. And I just keep going through the day. When I don't have appointments, I switch back into reading and researching and writing mode. And that goes on till about, I mean, it varies. I often take a nap for, you know, an hour in the afternoon, but then I get right back up and start back at it. And I'll go till 7 or 8, sometimes 9 at night. But by that point, I'm starting to get a little tired, and I may switch over and watch a few hours of video before going to bed.
Beth, thank you very much for the question. Lots of questions.
Yes. I also listen to audiobooks. Even when I'm lying down to go to sleep or take a nap, I'll listen to audiobooks. And I also listen to them when I'm driving. If I have errands to run, I listen to them then too. So that's another aspect of how I do research, how I do learn. And I'm just always listening to stuff whenever I have a moment.
Again, Beth, thank you very much for the question. This one comes from Smooth Criminal 53184.
If that Smooth Criminal's prison number.
I wonder. At first, I thought it was a Michael Jackson fan, but that could be Smooth Criminal's prison number. I have a few questions that I have on my mind for some time now. It is said, it's going to be a few questions. Just stop me if you want to just answer one, Jimmy. It is said that Latin is especially efficacious for prayer and exorcisms because it is the official language of the church. My question is this: for an Eastern Rite Catholic who would be under the authority of their church's head, although the Pope's authority is, of course, universal and preeminent, and have their own codes of canon law, would the native language of that church be more efficacious or similar in efficacy to prayers in Latin? Or would this only apply to the ancient languages? For example, Latin, Greek, Aramaic, Coptic, Hebrew, and possibly Church Slavonic and Arabic.
Well, the only way to settle this question would be by doing experiments, and nobody has actually experimented in this way. So we don't have a definitive answer. Even the idea that Latin is more efficacious than, say, English is anecdotal. It's not something that any exorcists, to my knowledge, have done a study on, you know, where you got two random populations of demoniacs and you exercise half of them in Latin and half of them in English and see which ones get delivered from demons the fastest. You know, no one's ever done that kind of study. In fact, you'd even want to do it double blind, but that would pose some special challenges. But, you know, we still have anecdotal reports of maybe Latin's more effective. And if that's the case, well, I can think of several reasons why that would be the case. First thing, I don't think it has anything to do with the demons, because demons do not need human language. They communicate their created spirits, their created intellects, and so they communicate mind to mind. Their own mode of communication is thus telepathic. So human language is something for humans. It really doesn't engage angelic nature. So why would the choice of a human language affect a demon more than another human language? Well, one reason could be it's based on the authorization of the church. So if the church has authorized a language for use, then it would be more effective than a language the church has not authorized for use. But then that puts English on the same plane as Latin, because both are, we have an English rite of exorcism that's just a translation of the Latin rite of exorcism. And so, you know, they would both have the advantage of being approved. There's also the fact, though, that Latin is sort of the standard or default or traditional language of the Latin Church. And maybe that gives it a little extra oomph. On the other hand, that leads us to a second consideration that could lead these lead Latin to be more effective than just standard English, if that's the case. Because remember, this is just an anecdotal claim. But if it's the case, one reason could be because it's more meaningful to the humans involved, to the exorcist, to the demoniac. If they view Latin as special in a way they don't view English as special, then the Latin would serve to strengthen their faith in God acting through this rite. And thus it might, that greater faith in God might make the rite more effective if the people have more faith in it. And so if the exorcist believes that Latin is going to be more effective, then it could be more effective. If the demoniac believes that Latin is going to be more effective to help free them of the demon, then that might make it more effective. It's thus, so I can see both the authorization of the church and the psychological effect of Latin playing a role here. All the same principles would therefore apply to any other language that an exorcism is authorized in, either elsewhere in the Catholic Church or outside of the Catholic Church, because you don't have to be a Catholic to kick bad spirits out of people. It's actually, exorcistic rites are very common all over the world in other religions too. But, and even Jesus acknowledged, you know, for example, there were Jewish exorcists who were legitimately driving out demons. In any event, if you're, let's say, in an Eastern rite of the Catholic Church, let's say your church uses Greek or Aramaic or Old Church Slavonic as its traditional language, well, and the rite is authorized in one of those languages, well, then it'll have the authorization efficacy. And if psychologically people involved, either the exorcist or the demoniac or the assistants, view that language, whether it's Greek or Aramaic or Old Church Slavonic, as this is going to be extra effective, well, then that would help increase your faith and help make it extra effective. So I don't think it has anything to do with the age of the language in particular. It's not like demons care about old human languages, because they don't care about human language at all. But the effect of the language on the humans who are participating, that I can see having a notable effect by virtue of increasing their faith as the rite is performed, as well as the authorization that the church has given to that language.
Smooth Criminal, thanks. That brings us to the break. Right back with more questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I'm continually amazed and humbled at the way God can work through me to help so many people. Although I have no idea what the caller's questions will be that day, I trust that the Holy Spirit can use my education and experience to guide, challenge, or comfort those who call.
Mast Appeal with Colleen Kelly Mast. Saturday morning, 9 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything, and all the questions are in. It's an internet version of Ask Me Anything, and this one comes from Sion Tan. And what are your thoughts, Jimmy, about whether animals and our pets can be in heaven with us or not?
Well, going back to Aristotelian philosophy, it was believed that the soul of an animal, which is what's known as a sensitive soul rather than a rational soul like humans have, is something that doesn't survive death, according to various medieval theologians like St. Thomas Aquinas. And that's kind of been a default opinion for many through Christian history. But it is not a matter of church teaching. So this is just theological speculation on the part of Aquinas and those who agree with him. And therefore, the opinion has no greater weight than the arguments that can be brought forward in its favor. So I actually did an episode of Mysterious World on this topic. It's episode 203. So you can find it by going to mysterious.com/203. And I went through the arguments that Aquinas proposed for why animal souls would not survive death. And I frankly found them unconvincing. I didn't think they proved what he wanted them to prove. And this is another example where I think, I mean, I have a great respect for Aquinas, but I think he sometimes tried to do too much with philosophy and settle points philosophically, where you need to take biblical data and empirical data into account more. And it so happens we have some empirical data that would support the existence of it, of an afterlife for at least some animals. People have what are known as near-death experiences, where they clinically die and they continue to have conscious experiences, and then the doctors are able to restart their hearts and they can come back and tell us about these experiences. And there's a particular class of near-death experiences that are what are called peak-in-Darien experiences. The phrase peak-in-Darien, it comes from an old poem. We won't worry about that. But the essence of a peak-in-Darien experience is where either on your deathbed before you die or in the afterlife after you clinically died, you see somebody that you did not know was dead. And then then it turns out that person was dead. So in the case of a near-death experience, you die clinically. Let's say your relatives come to greet you and you see your grandfather who you knew was dead, and you see your mother who you knew was dead. But then for some reason, your little sister is here and you didn't know she was dead. And then they restart your heart and you say, well, I saw grandfather and I saw mom, but then I saw my little sister and she's not dead. And they say, well, actually, she is. We didn't want to tell you, but your little sister recently died. And that's what's known as the peak-in-Darien experience. Well, it so happens that not only do people see their departed human relatives when they have near-death experiences, they also see animals. And I searched a database of thousands of near-death experiences for terms like cat, dog, horse, pet, rabbit, things like that. And depending on how you parse it, like, there could be as many as a quarter of near-death experiences involve seeing animals in the afterlife. And some of these are veridical. There's, for example, a notable case of a guy who clinically died. He was greeted by his grandmother and his cat, whom he believed was at home waiting for him while he was in the hospital. And after they restart his heart, he describes his experience and they say, yeah, actually, your cat died while you were in the hospital. So that would be empirical evidence that that at least some animals have something of an afterlife, because if near-death experiences give us evidence for an afterlife in general, like for other humans, like grandfather and mom and so forth, well, they're going to give us evidence for an animal afterlife too. So I think that I think we need to be more open on this subject, and you can check out mysterious.fm/203 for more information.
Sion Tan, thank you very much for the question. This one comes from a user, and then there's a user number after it. Does the church condone organ donation? There's two different questions. You want to take them one at a time, Jimmy, or just read the whole thing?
Oh, we can take them one at a time. So the church does condone organ donation. It is a praiseworthy act, provided that that they're not taking a vital organ, meaning one you need to live. So don't let them take your heart, because you need your heart to live. And in fact, I do not have I want to donate my organs checked on my driver's license because they will kill you to get your heart. If they think you're damaged and not going to survive, they will take your heart and that will kill you. And so that's direct, that's homicide. So I can't recommend being an organ donor in that sense. But if someone is already dead, and they don't harvest dead hearts, they only harvest living ones. But if the organ is harvested after death, that's fine. If the organ is harvested before death and is non-vital, meaning you can live without it, then it's praiseworthy to do that. So fundamentally, the church is okay with organ donation, but there are some stipulations to make sure it's done in an ethical way, and the ethical way does not involve killing living people.
All right, user, there's that one. And then user has this question. Also, should we vote for a candidate who is for abortion when there is no one who is pro-life? Should we vote for the lesser of two evils?
Well, so if you have no good options, then if you're going to vote, then yeah, you should use your vote to do the most good possible and avoid the most evil possible. And so if you have no one who is completely pro-life, then no one with a realistic chance of winning. I mean, you could always nominate the Pope or someone, but he's not going to win the election. So you have to look realistically at how you use your vote. And if none of the candidates that has a plausible chance of winning is where they need to be, which is frankly normally the case, then you pick the one that's least bad. And that can mean justifying someone, voting for someone who's not fully pro-life or even not pro-life at all, provided the other candidates that have a realistic chance of winning are even worse. Also an option in some situations is just not voting. But in the main, we want to be active participants in our democracy. And in the main, we want to vote and use our vote in a way that accomplishes the most good and avoids the most evil.
Thanks for those two questions, user. On we go. This is from SD Popesplainer. I don't know if that's San Diego or South Dakota, but either way, I have full confidence that you are knowledgeable about the identity issue. What would you offer in Scripture and the Catechism to someone who identified as a furry?
Well, I know some on this question, but frankly, I haven't really, I haven't thought too much about furries. I'm aware of the concept. I have never spoken with someone who claims to identify as an animal, which is my understanding of what a furry would be. I've certainly never talked to anyone who's really serious about it. I can imagine someone like enjoys dressing up as an animal, you know, but to really identify as or think that they are an animal when in fact they're human would be a sign of mental illness of some form. And because it's for if someone really thought I am a dog when they're clearly a human, I mean, that's psychosis. That's a psychotic break with reality if they really think that. And so if I'm limited to Scripture and the Catechism, I would focus on those parts of Scripture and the Catechism that talk about God making man and making animals and pointing out you're in this category. You're not in this other category. So, you know, Genesis 1 would be a good text for that. Genesis 2 could also be a possible text for that. There are other passages as well. But it's, you know, hopefully the person doesn't really think that they're an animal, because it should be fairly easy to point out, you know, look, you have, let's say someone thinks they're a sheep. Well, okay, you're not covered in wool, and you've got front-mounted eyes. You not side-mounted eyes like a sheep. You're bipedal, and sheep are quadrupedal. You know, you sheep have tails. You don't got a tail, so you're clearly a human being here. Now, if you feel an affinity for sheep, that's fine. You know, people can love animals and care about animals and stuff like that. But you need to recognize what you really are, and you need to be okay with what you really are. If you're not okay with it, then that's a sign that there's something wrong. And that something wrong would, since it's a mental thing, it would be a psychological thing. And I would suggest getting psychological help with that, because it's not properly ordered for a human to feel that they're a sheep rather than a human. The reality is you're a human, and our feelings need to be brought in line with that. And if our feelings are not in line with that, well, that's understandable, but that's a subject that needs, because humans are broken, but that's something that needs to be addressed. And so I would, in addition to talking to them about scripture and the catechism, I would encourage them to get mental assistance.
SD Popesplainer, thank you very much for the question. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. If you've got a question, if you want to get in on one of these internet Ask Me Anythings, you should check out Jimmy Akin's various social media, and you can contact him. You're always welcome to send us an email at radio@catholic.com, and we'll gather them up and we'll get them to Jimmy and try to get your question on the air. It's a lot of fun to do these internet. A lot of times it makes it available to people who aren't available to pick up the phone and call while we're on the air. So maybe you're in a time zone or a country or a situation that makes it difficult to call, and you'd like to get in on one of these internet Ask Me Anythings. radio@catholic.com, or just get it to Jimmy one way or another, and we'll do our best to get it on. We got lots more to come right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Many people have forgotten just how revolutionary the Bible creation stories are, but the first three chapters of Genesis are a powerful challenge to anyone in any generation who would undervalue human lives. In the Beginning, the new book by Monica Migliorino Miller will take you on a fantastic journey through the first chapters of Genesis, unfolding the richness of life as God sees it. Get In the Beginning today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
When it comes to Catholic teachings about Mary, there's one question we hear more than any other. Where is that in the Bible? The answer? Everywhere. In Bible Mary, the Mother of Jesus and the Word of God, Father John Weiss opens Scripture to reveal a Mary who has been hiding in plain sight. Order your copy of Bible Mary today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's an Ask Me Anything. All the questions this time from the internet. And some of the folks have given us their real names. Some of them using their internet name. And this one I would assume is not a given name. Lost Archivist asks this.
That's
Jimmy.
A cool name, though.
It I is mean, a cool
is
name.
Is he an archivist of the Lost Archive? Or is he an archivist who is lost?
Yeah, right. And that is a good name for you, Jimmy. It's a mysterious name.
this Lost, is not me, though.
Lost Archivist wants to know this. Given the tragic shortage of priests, what would you recommend to someone seeking a spiritual director who is having a hard time finding one?
Well, there are a number of options. One of the things that I've done in the past is seek a spiritual director, not from a diocesan priest, because they're often very busy with parish life, but and don't necessarily have a lot of time. But I've gone to monasteries and had a spiritual director who lives at the monastery, and their life is a little bit different because they're focused around the activities of the monastery, so they're keeping busy that way, but they don't have the same pastoral demands that a parish priest does. So that's one possibility. On the other hand, another possibility would be telecommuting, because, you know, all you got to be able to do for spiritual direction is converse. And these days we can converse at a distance, mm-hmm. and people are doing telemedicine, and there's no reason they can't do telespiritual direction. So you might, if there's not a priest locally who you can talk with, you could do video appointments with them, either on your phone or over the internet. You want to make sure that you're talking in a secure way if you're talking about anything sensitive, but you could do that. You know, people, like I said, people do telemedicine, they do telecounseling, they could do telespiritual direction. And that again would be open to both diocesan priests and monastic priests. You might seek out a retired priest to serve as a spiritual director. On the other hand, you don't have to stick with a priest, because being a priest is not a requirement for being a spiritual director. There are other people who do spiritual direction. Deacons sometimes do spiritual direction. Nuns sometimes do spiritual direction. Monks sometimes do spiritual direction. Lay people sometimes do spiritual direction. The qualifications you're looking for is, does this person have a good, strong sense of the faith, of Catholic faith and morals? And are they a wise person who can give me an objective perspective on the issues that are of concern to me? And so don't limit yourself to a priest if you have trouble finding a priest. I've even had requests to be spiritual director before. Unfortunately, I don't have time to. But you don't have to limit yourself to just a priest, because what you're really looking for is someone that has a firm grasp of Catholic faith and morals, and who has the ability to converse with you and give you an objective and wise perspective on the issues that are of concern to you in your own spiritual life.
I hope that was helpful to you, Lost Archivist. Thank you very much for the question. This next one comes from CW4821. I'd like your advice on what to tell my 9-year-old about Blessed Imelda Lambertini, the young girl who reportedly died of joy upon receiving the Eucharist. After hearing about Blessed Imelda, my 9-year-old is scared that the Eucharist will kill her too. And for my own curiosity, do you know if this is a documented account or more of a pious legend? Thanks.
Well, this is apparently more of a documented account. Imelda Lambertini, Blessed Imelda Lambertini, lived in the 1300s. Memory serves, she actually died at 11 rather than 9, if I recall correctly. But apparently the account was documented fairly early on. So this is not like a legend that is first recorded hundreds of years after the person allegedly lived. This is something we apparently have contemporaneous information about. And she was declared blessed in the 1800s and is in fact a patron saint of first communicants. The account of it that you may have heard, though, may not be fully accurate. My understanding is, so Imelda had asked to receive Holy Communion at age 5, which is earlier than was customary in her day. It is possible for a child to receive communion that early. In fact, I've heard it reported that Pius XII would sometimes give communion to children who were age 5, but it wasn't common in Imelda's day. It was common at a later age. And she then joined a convent, and she continued to request the Eucharist. And then at a certain point, one of the, I guess, priests who was present saw like a special sign over her, like the Eucharist appearing above her head. And he took that as a sign to go ahead and give her communion. So he did. And then after, and she didn't just die of joy. That you may have heard someone say that, but that is not what's in the account I've read. In the account I've read, there was this miracle where, like, a priest saw the sign of the Eucharist above her, took that as a sign to go ahead and give her communion. He gives her communion. Then she goes back to her pew to say prayers, and then stuff kind of goes on. And then, you know, the life of the monastery goes on. Eventually, it gets time for a meal, so they come looking for Imelda, and one of the sisters, you know, sees her and calls her name, but she doesn't move. And so she goes up and taps her, and at that point, they realize Imelda's dead. And so it wasn't that she received the Eucharist and was so overjoyed she just died. That's not what happened. She received the Eucharist, she went back to her pew to say prayers, and then at some unknown point, she died. And given that her receiving communion in the first place was preceded by a miraculous sign that told the priest, go ahead and give her communion, this could have been God's way of ensuring that she received communion before she died. She may have had some medical condition that was going to mean she would go to be with God that day, and God wanted to make sure that she did get the communion that she wanted before that happened. And so what we can say is that she received communion near the time she died, but that doesn't tell us that she died because she received communion. It very well may be she was going to die anyway, and God made sure that she got communion before she died. So I would say this is a very, so that's one reason why your daughter need not fear this, unless, you know, there's a miraculous sign just before she gets communion that, you know, we're not even in the same situation. And even if there was a miraculous sign, it wouldn't mean the same thing is going to happen. Fundamentally, this is a rare situation. This is like the only time that has come to public attention that this has ever happened in 2,000 years. And there have been billions of Catholics in the last 2,000 years receiving Holy Communion, and they just don't get killed when they receive Holy Communion. So given all that, I would say that your 9-year-old really doesn't have anything to worry about here. Communion is a sign of God's love for us. And we should receive it as an act of love for him. And we don't really need to worry or be afraid. This is an anomalous situation, and Jesus is not trying to kill us by coming to us in communion. He's trying to love us by coming to us in communion.
CW, thank you for that. I hope that was helpful for you and for your daughter. This one comes from Alistair. The strongest challenge I ever heard from a Protestant about the Assumption is, how can the Catholic Church dogmatically declare that the Assumption was believed at all times by the Church when there is literally no evidence anywhere in the Bible, Church Father writings, or apocryphal writings of the first century?
Okay, so we've got an artificial limitation here to the first century. So what this person is demanding in this objection that you've heard, Alistair, is that we cough up first century evidence for this. Well, the vast majority of Christian literature that people are familiar with from the first century is the writings of the New Testament. But is it true that the New Testament doesn't contain anything about the Assumption? Well, actually, that's debatable. Because we have Revelation 12, where John sees a woman in heaven who gives birth to the Messiah, and she's caught up. She's depicted initially as being in heaven, but also she is later caught up to escape from the persecution of the dragon. And this woman gives birth to the Messiah. So, you know, pop quiz, Psychelet, who is the mother of the Messiah?
Oh, I can do this one. Mary.
Yeah. So this woman is in some sense Mary. Now, that doesn't mean it's only Mary, because one of the things we know about the book of Revelation is John uses what's called polyvalent symbolism. That is, a single symbol can stand for more than one thing. But, you know, when you're an ancient reader and you see woman gives birth to Messiah, oh, that's Mary, is going to be one of the first things you think of. You may also notice, okay, so she's clothed in the sun and has the moon at her feet and has a crown of 12 stars. That sounds like Jacob's dream in Genesis, so she could also represent Israel or the spiritual Israel, the church. So there can be other dimensions to who this woman is too, but Mary's one of them. And given that she's depicted as being in heaven and as being caught up to get away from the devil, both of those could be references to the Assumption. So I would say the claim is not proven that there is no reference to it in first century Christian literature. The second, or in the New Testament, this passage is arguably exactly that. Well, what about outside of the New Testament? Well, the thing is, we have very little that's outside of the New Testament from the first century. And if you pick many Christian doctrines, it takes a few centuries before we have a record of it. And simply because of how little literature we have from the first century, you cannot expect every given doctrine, especially doctrines of a lesser nature, to be reflected in first century literature. What we can say about the Assumption is it is reflected in literature that dates from the 200s and 300s. But if you're imposing an artificial constraint of the first century, then you're asking for an unreasonable test, because there is so little from that time period that we cannot expect that it would be mentioned in the literature we have, given how little of that literature has survived.
That will bring us to the break. Alistair, thank you very much for the question. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hi, this is Mike Aquilina with a few words about St. Basil the Great. St. Basil is known as a pastor and thinker. He wrote theological masterpieces still read today. But he was also a builder who found new institutional forms for Christian charity. He built a complex that included a hospital, a hostel, a soup kitchen, a trade school. It was so vast it was called the New City, like the New Jerusalem coming down from heaven.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's an Ask Me Anything episode. And all the questions have already been asked. They're in. I just get to read them to Jimmy. Our Lord, that's the letter R, Lord 017 asks this: what separates the new atheists from the old atheists? And what are the beliefs of the new atheists?
Well, what separates the new atheists from the old atheists is Brandon. It's just a matter of Brandon. Their beliefs are the same. They're both atheists. There's no real difference, except that a group of folks who were authors and speakers publishing in this area, this got called the New Atheists. And so they were a kind of public revival of atheism a revival of atheism in the public sphere that generated some noise. So to the extent that they're different than the atheists who preceded them or the atheists that followed them, because they've started to fade from the scene, I would say, well, they had a knack for making some, getting some extra publicity, basically. And they got branded as the new atheists, and that was a hot term for a while, but it's kind of faded. Several of the so-called four horsemen of the new atheism, like Daniel Dennett, you know, have passed on, and others like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris have somewhat faded from the scene. So they're not as prominent as they were, but basically this was a branded move to try to attract new attention to atheism, but it was fundamentally the same old atheism. I don't know, I'm tempted to say that the new atheists had a bit more attitude than some of the atheists that preceded them, but you know, putting it politely, I could put it more bluntly and say they were bigger jerks, but you know, I'm tempted to say they had a bit more attitude, but I don't know that that's the case, because if you go back into the 20th century and look at some of the atheists there, like A.J. Ayer, for example, or Bertrand Russell, you know, they could have some attitude as well. And if you go back to Voltaire, oh, wow, do you get attitude. So I don't know that they were particularly distinct in the attitude that they displayed.
All right. Well, thank you very much, R, for the question. On we go. Jackie wants to know this. If there are many other planets with life, then how would they be saved? Did Christ's death and resurrection count for them also? And if so, how would they know? Or did God save each planet with aliens differently?
Well, you asked some good questions, and unfortunately, we don't know the answers, because we don't know if there are other planets with intelligent life. There very well may be, but we don't know for sure, and we haven't made contact with them, so we haven't had a chance to find out about them and what provisions God may have made for them. It's possible that they might not need salvation, because they may never have fallen into sin in the first place. It's also possible they did fall, and they fell in an irrevocable way, like the angels did, in which case they wouldn't be saved. On the other hand, if they're like us and they fell into sin in a revocable way, then God could save them through the death of Christ here on earth, because Christ paid an infinite price when he died on the cross. And so that would be sufficient to cover their sins. And if God chooses to apply Christ's human death to them, then it would be efficacious for them, and they could be saved through Christ. In terms of how they would know about Christ, well, God could reveal it to them, or he could just be merciful to them until we make contact and can tell them about Christ. The same way here on earth, the last time we found a new world, when people from the old world, meaning Europe, found the Americas or the new world, well, God had been merciful with the Native Americans until the missionaries could get over here and tell them about Jesus. The same thing could happen with another planet. On the other hand, it's also possible that Jesus could incarnate on their planet. You know, Thomas Aquinas points out, once you've incarnated once, that shows you can do this. It's within the power of omnipotence. And since God is omnipotent, he could incarnate more than once, and he could do that and save an alien planet that same way. Or, since Aquinas also points out, you know, God didn't have to redeem us through Jesus's death. He could have done it any number of ways. It's possible God could save people of an alien world any number of ways that didn't involve Jesus dying on a cross, or he may have just applied Jesus's death on a cross here on earth to them. Ultimately, we'll have to sort all that out after we meet him.
Jackie.
If we meet him.
Thanks very much for the question, Jackie. This one comes from Raphael. What are some of the best ways to practice becoming as humble as possible, like Our Lady?
Well, I would say meditating on Our Lady is one way of doing that. You know, thinking about even though she's the mother of God, she doesn't show herself off. You know, she's barely in the New Testament. I mean, she is there, but she's not, it's not all about her. And she, and that reflects her son's will, and therefore that reflects Mary's will. Mary endorses the will of her son, and she wants her son to be the focus. So thinking about ourselves in relation, and Mary's example, is a way to grow in humility, to realize it's about him. It's not all about us. And we don't need to have, you know, super, super, super prominence. Also, in a practical way, deferring to others, you know, it's something that's recommended in the New Testament. You know, Jesus says, take a lower seat and wait for someone to move you up higher. Don't just assume the more prominent seat at a banquet. Well, in the same way, look for opportunities in our lives to serve others and be humble and defer to others and not press our rights and not press ourselves forward and generally be a loving person. I mean, one of the things is humility is a direct outgrowth of love. So, and love, as we know, is God's highest priority. That's why it's the two great commandments, love God and love your neighbor. So, if you genuinely think about how can I be loving to other people, that's going to put you in a position of humility. And so the more you can genuinely love other people, the more humble you're going to end up being. And the more you're going to be fulfilling the commands that God is most concerned that you fulfill.
Raphael, thank you very much for the question. On and on we go because there's a few more minutes left and there's lots of questions here. Jackie asks, is it possible for your guardian angel not to like you or something about you? For example, maybe your guardian angel doesn't like the same kind of music you listen to. I wonder if a guardian angel ever feels like they preferred getting someone else to guide.
Well, I would say on that last question, no. I think every guardian angel, because they're confirmed in goodness and blessedness, is going to be happy there with the person they're guarding. It's not like, oh, I got this guy. I wish I had someone else. They don't think that way. They may recognize I have greater challenges as a guardian than some of my fellow guardians, but they're up for those challenges. So they're not going to be unhappy about having you as a charge. Does that mean they're going to approve of everything that you do? Of course not. That's one of the reasons you need a guardian, is to help protect you from some of the mistakes that humans make. So, you know, if you're listening to satanic death metal thrash rock or whatever, your guardian angel is not going to approve of that. On the other hand, if you're not listening to anything bad, you know, let's say you're listening to, you know, country rock, it's not like your guardian angel is going to say, oh, he really should be listening to country rather than country rock. You know, that's something that angels are not really going to care about, human music. That's kind of like, we don't really care about, does my dog prefer to eat, you know, this kind of meat or that kind of meat? It's like, if whatever my dog prefers, that's okay. That's a dog thing. You know, I don't really have an opinion on what a dog's tastes are. And in the same way, there's a lot of stuff about you and me that our guardian angel is not really going to have an opinion about, because it's not really relevant to his job guarding us. It's only going to be on the things he's really going to be concerned about, is my human doing good stuff or is he doing bad stuff? So yeah, they would have, if you're doing something bad or something that's not helpful, you know, then yeah, they wouldn't prefer that, but they're still up for guarding you and they care about you and they're looking out for you. They got your back.
All right, Jackie. Thanks very much for the question. This one comes from Trent. I hope this seems very serious, this question. Who would win in a fight, the Incredible Hulk or felony tax evasion? Asking for a friend.
It's going to depend on the nature of the fight in question. If it's a physical fight, then the Incredible Hulk is going to win, because felony tax evasion just does not have the same physical strength that the Hulk has. So if it's a physical fight, the Hulk is going to win. On the other hand, if it's a financial fight, then felony tax evasion is going to win, because the Hulk is too enraged to be able to take on the tactics that are involved in felony tax evasion. And so felony tax evasion would win in that case.
Excellent question. What's one everyone's asking though, Trent? But thanks. Well, you know, somebody's got to ask it. Katarina.
I like how he says at the end of it, asking for a friend.
Yeah, it's like he doesn't. I don't care who would win between the Hulk and felony. You want to try this other question or no? That's too long.
We're getting that's kind of a long one.
Yeah. All right. So what about
skip down to the next one.
All right. Bill, Why was it necessary for the church to make the Immaculate Conception and Assumption into dogmas versus leaving them as non-mandatory for belief teachings?
Well, it wasn't necessary, but necessity is not the only criterion when it comes to proclaiming something definitively. The fundamental criterion is truth. If something's true, then it can be proclaimed infallibly. And it was true that that Mary was immaculately conceived and that she was assumed into heaven. And Pius IX and Pius XII chose to infallibly define it. For example, a parallel would be the existence of angels. You know, that's not a major doctrine, but it is in the Bible and it could be infallibly defined because it's true. And in the same way, these popes determined that this is true, and they wanted to make that abundantly clear, which is what infallible teaching is.
Bill, thank you for the question. Thanks, everybody, for the question. Thank you, Jimmy, for being here with us for 2 hours.
My pleasure.
And that will do it for us. If you want to get your questions to us, shoot them over to radio@catholic.com or get them to Jimmy if you want to be on the next Internet Ask Me Anything. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.